Jack Churchill on March 27th.
Yeah. What was Mike's thrust, by the way?
Well, it was as you described it. I think he was, you know, mostly concerned with the wildlife. I did a interview with him and this project just because he was, you know, he's obviously got a high profile as
He's done a lot in the basin. There's no question. And I think that all that work that was done up in, I think the whole thing that at Hillsborough was really probably. There's another person or two involved, but I think he had a lot of influence in getting that thing going.
You mean the Jackson Bottom wetlands?
Didn't he have something in that?
He was, he was involved. He was, I think, peripherally involved. It was Jim Harp, realtor in Hillsborough.
And, but he gave a lot of support from Audubon. And,
I think
it's very important. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, because that legitimized a lot, you see. Mm-hmm. So I would say it was very critical and crucial to have that effort going on in parallel action. Mm-hmm. And my concerns about, Mike gets to be very important in an issue, and he tries to carry the weight of all the environmentalists and all the water quality, and he's compromising out my objectives for his objective. And that's just and I don't think that's really being too critical. Mm-hmm. Being just, that's the way it is when you have different policy thrusts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's involved now in something called the Coalition for a Livable Future, too. I don't know if you know much about that, but it brings together a wide variety of people more concerned with urban issues, mm-hmm. I would say.
I did a seminar, and, you know, he put on those things, those meetings, and out of those, you know, those conferences he had?
No, I don't know about this.
He put those on, I think. We did one on urban streams in my seminar. I did some papers on those, and so we worked very closely on some of those. Mm-hmm. And the urban stream thing, I think he did more of a thrust for. I worried a lot about that. My entire experience, urban streams are doomed from the start, from a hydrological standpoint. That once you keep destroying the watershed. This is all the work at John Hopkins said there was no urban stream that had any viability in the whole world. And so what we've done in Oregon, I mean, this is true. Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C., gone is a viable stream. It's just a carrying off water because all the upper watershed is gone. Mm-hmm. Rock Creek used to be a beautiful flowing stream, and now it's just kind of a gray mattered sewer and stuff. And I think what Mike has done really is preserve probably some stream and water bodies in the metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. Of course, we've had the parkland to do it. Balch Creek or something.
Balch Creek, yeah.
Balch Creek and Tryon Creek. I don't think he had too much to do with, but in the wake of Oswego, and it's not very healthy anyhow.
Yeah.
But because the upper watershed again has been pretty butchered.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other, in Johnson Creek, whatever restoration work's gone, is it headed in the right direction? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, we'll... I think that most urban streams that I've seen get into a irreversible rate of degradation. And that's the problem with this guy that wants to just raise the phosphate level. In water quality, what the only administrator in this way to do this kind of isn't quite consistent with what I was saying before, but I never have been very consistent, is that we should be looking at trends. It's a trend that counts, not the point. And if you got 13,000 violations, you got a trend. That's the important thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. If it's a downward trend, at some state, hydrologically, and it's a downward trend because there's been hydrological disturbances, well, the water quality disturbances, probably, you are going to get into an irreversible state at some point in terms of the viability of that stream as it was. Can be greatly reduced, and it will probably not be able to recover. But maybe that's nature too. you know, nature's a moving thing too, so maybe a lot of this is going on in nature. Mm-hmm. But man can help that along. Mm-hmm. So the question is, to me always is, can this stream be turned around into an upward trend rather than a downward trend? And this is where I think on the Tualatin is, that I think we've seen improvement rather than continued degradation. So to me, it is an enormous success story being a largely urbanized stream now. Mm-hmm. No matter what the levels they talk about and all this, we're seeing trends upward rather than trend downward. Mm-hmm. And all of these water quality samplers says, you know, it's 8.5 rather than 7.2. Well, you know, okay, if that was a trend, that's good, okay, but the instantaneous measurement, since it's fallacious in the first place, isn't very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, another interesting thing I think about the success story on the Tualatin. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's definitely...
We haven't talked about it. Let's talk about that for a while.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I at this conference that I mentioned that I attended earlier, that was definitely the sort of keynote of it. People, you know, came up and talked again and again about how successful the cleanup effort was on the Tualatin. And USA, of course, now, despite the history of exactly how they got there, is quite proud of their role. Of,
Well, that's all right. Let them take credit. Yeah. Mm, that's fine.
And so it, you know, it, you know, it is a success story. And I guess, you know, what are your thoughts on what should be done with this success story? is the question.
Oh, I don't know. It'll have its own, you know, that the success story, I think, is not in the river. I don't think it's a success story. And I don't think it's in USA. The success story, and if it's a continuing phenomena of upward trend, and let's say that the measure is an upward trend, as far as the river is concerned, so it's a success story, period. But the thing that got it there and the thing that will keep it there is that people rediscovered the river. And as the use of the river expands, the water quality trend will keep upward, if the political pressure is there, regardless of what the technical aspects are. If the people don't use the river and the public interest is not in it, then I believe that the water quality will again turn downward, regardless of what the technical fixes are. So the more public access you get, the more public use you get, the more public... The better the water quality will be over the longer period. Now that's, you know, you may run into all sorts of problems along the way. But look what I think maybe the most important thing out of the suit against USA was this $1 million to start getting people involved in looking at things. Mm-hmm. Okay, really, I mean, you know, if the money that's gotten into the schools, that's gotten into the communities, that's gotten into the family, you know, and all of this is terribly important. Over time. That's my view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in fact, I guess to the extent...
The fact that there were conferences out there.
Yeah.
And we patted ourselves on the back. My God.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I had this little group out there, just 10 years ago. And we were sitting around in a little sewage treatment hall and maybe 20 of us and trying to figure out where the river was and where it had been and where it was going. I mean, in just a kind of esoteric vacuum. Now you had real life people. I mean, most of the people didn't even live in the basin probably that I had.
Yeah.
You know how many people did you have there?
Oh, it was pretty well
attended. How many?
Oh, I'm going to guess that I'm not necessarily terribly good at this, but 100 folks maybe.
All living in the basin?
Yeah, mostly. Most of them.
Yeah.
I don't live in the basin myself.
Well, I know, but I mean, isn't that fantastic? And they represent a lot of groups.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Well, I mean, that was the other thing I was going to say too, is that some of this money, of course, is going to support groups such as the River Keepers and the Friends of Fano. And I'm just wondering, it almost seems like there's a strategic value in having these citizens groups out there too, kind of.
The citizens group?
Yeah, the citizens groups.
If it wasn't for the citizens group, you wouldn't have Fano Creek. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. If it wouldn't, I mean, I don't know the exact work of the of the river keepers, you know, that kind of picked up where we dropped it off, and so it rediscovered the river keepers, as we say, but that's fine.
Yeah.
But what they really did was to organize, didn't they start out organizing those canoe trips?
And yes, they did.
Okay, but look what that brought. I mean, that was a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
But that did more than all the money that went to all the technical studies that USA did in terms of getting that river cleaned up. And one of those, just, you know, people going down the river. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, just a story and so on. But the people started using the river, and my God, I mean, I really believe that. Mm-hmm. Oh. This happened in Bear Creek. We fooled around technically with Bear Creek for a long time, and then people in Medford, Nashville, and they started really starting to stop and look at the river, and it's beginning to get cleaned up. Mm-hmm. And the city council of Ashland is having a hell of a time not making the right decision. I mean, they're a good city council, but still. Mm-hmm. Until people really started screaming about their creek, it didn't move very much. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, we built public involvement into the Water Quality Act and so on, but you don't make public involvement through federal legislation. If the values of the urban people are get in, you know, understand their needs for water and demand the use of their water, you know, they will get it. Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing that we have to go back to is that the water belongs to the people of Oregon. It doesn't belong to USA, mm-hmm, or any of those people.
It's a public good. Maybe your hosts are here. Is that,
oh,
is that who's in the backyard?
I don't know.
Oh, there's a fellow with gray hair.
Yeah.
And kind of black turtleneck.
I'll see.
Okay. Okay. Well, maybe just the last thing to talk about is the you know, the resistance that USA put up to getting on board with this,
mm-hmm,
stands sort of in contrast to, relatively speaking anyway, how little trouble it was for them to actually meet the phosphate standards. I know they had to spend some money, and I know that the, mm-hmm, cost of sewer hookups is now higher in Washington County than it used to be.
Right.
But in the beginning, I think there was a perception out there that the end of the world had come, and that it wasn't possible to make these, yeah, standards.
Bob, this is Michael Rook. But the question you asked is, since it was so easy to clean up, why did they fight it so hard?
That's essentially the question. I never quite asked, right? But yeah, that is the question. For one thing, I suppose it wasn't totally apparent to
Colleen. This is Michael O'Rourke, Colleen Bird.
Hi.
Michael works for the Oregon Historical Society. Well, I think my answer really is in the fact that USA was not a sewage treatment agency, but a public relations agency, and they never seriously looked at management of their plant. In fact, I had thought very seriously of bringing in Japanese witnesses to show how these plants could be operated if we ever went to court. You know, because Bob Bird visited Japan and told how, you know, same equipment could be operated, you know, very good capacity. They had no meters, they never monitored, and implant monitoring, now they had no real control, quality control of what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And they didn't care. See, most, it was fine, just as the people they hired had no quality objectives. And as I said, the manager, Gary, was only interested in getting hookups. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a threat. Our threat was that it would be, and we probably talked about this a little bit, you don't want another moratorium.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, well, I think it was the threat of a moratorium, which is the real measurement of his success,
uh-huh,
was the thing that got the argument going, is they didn't, you know,
mm-hmm,
Mm-hmm. And so, like on many things, the battle wasn't fought on the real issues. Mm-hmm. But it was clear when we disposed the plant treatment people, you know, it was incredibly stupid. And mismanagement is so, you know, I mean, Thane Timpson has those depositions. They might, or, I don't know, they wade through them. I don't know if it's worth your while, but it's, that's my view. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, you know, because... Yeah, I think the level of confidence was really low. I don't think Gary Treatment never had any. He was just a little old local boy that made good. Mm-hmm. He had never any background in, I don't have any technical training.
Yeah, not much, actually.
No, he's a sewage treatment plant operator, you know, which, you know, I mean, Christ, that's once a year training, 1 week or 1 day. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did nothing.
Yeah.
And the people he hired were terrible. In terms of their technical competence. So here you had a Cadillac and you had a, you know. But Bob Bird would probably know more about that. That's a good question for him. Mm-hmm. But also I think we attacked and remember the county commission was all development. And they met kind of privately with, you know, it was always kind of a closed meeting when Gary reported to the commission. Mm-hmm. And I think it was all just about development. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, My response. They didn't care whether they could or not. They just wanted to shut down. Mm-hmm. So they hired, you know, people to say they couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, of course, now the perception is that this was all a good thing to do because they, I think they're feeling now that that even for the developers, it's turned out to be better, because of the moratorium threat and all the rest of it. Yeah, and quality of life, all the rest of it.
Yeah, and one of the things we want to get into, I think, you know, is John Jackson's role in this and how incompetent he's been in terms of the non-point source issue.
Okay.
Yeah. Have you interviewed him at all?
No, I haven't.
But well, I don't know how we can get into that very easily, and I don't know if I have much to say.
Okay.
I don't think, I've done, again, a good public relations job, but nothing in the substance.
Okay. Now, Jackson's position was what again?
Well, he's basin manager, I guess, for the USA.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
When I first went to DEQ, he was dumped on me, and he's the most worthless person.
Okay, well, why don't we call it a day, and we'll maybe do a follow-up interview nowhere near this duration, but but we'll pick up some points later on. Okay, thanks again. It's been really a great interview. I think
thank
it's very, very interesting history.
Uh-huh. Well,